Good afternoon and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryant, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. Here I usually make mention of the great audience we have today, but as you know by now, this program is pre-recorded, there is no audience. We did that because our guest is Jonathan Shanzer of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He is in fact one of my favorite guests, and apparently he's one of everyone's favorite guests because we had so much trouble pinning him down to a time that we decided to record on his schedule. I know if you watch the whole program, you will agree with me that it is worth it to do it this way. So I'm going to introduce the JPC to you again, and if you've heard this before, well, hear it again. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization established in 1985. We provide analysis of foreign and domestic policy by leading scholars and academics. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. And as it has been since 10/7, our most important job is to support the government of Israel and the IDF in their defense of people and the borders of Israel, in those borders and over those borders, ensuring that Hamas has neither the military power it had or governing capability, and securing the release of the remaining deceased hostages. You may notice I'm still wearing my hostage pin until every hostage is home and properly cared for. There are still hostages. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates domestically for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. You can find us on our website at jewishpolicycenter.org. You will find our insight articles, our In Context blog, and In Focus Quarterly. Right now, you can read the fall 2025 edition of In Focus Quarterly entitled Identity, Borders, and Conflict. You can imagine where that goes. You can also find videos of our previous webinars. They're good for binge watching. And speaking of our videos and enlightening speakers, let me introduce Jonathan Shanzer, our guest. John is the executive director of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. His areas of expertise span China, economic security, including sanctions and illicit finance, Iran-backed terrorism, which includes the Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, Syria, and more. Do you need more? He covers Syria, Palestinian politics, Israel, and actually where I want to start today, which is Turkey and the role of Turkey in the Gaza ceasefire and the future of the region. He previously worked as a terrorism finance analyst at the Department of the Treasury, where he played an integral role in the designation of numerous terror financiers. He spent time at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and Middle East Forum, and he sat in my chair here at the Jewish Policy Center. John, I hope I'm living up to the standard that you set. So I'm going to ask you to start the program by setting the stage. Seven front war, rocket and missile attacks, terror and warfare in Gaza. And you wrote this week, Israel stood unwavering in the face of withering assaults, one more punishing than the next. And with the help of the American president, it emerged from the fighting bruised, but intact. Let's talk about where they are now. Maybe more than intact. Give us the positives, give us the negatives, but most importantly, give us Turkey.
Okay. Well, Shoshana, you are more than living up to those expectations. It's wonderful to see the JPC go from strength to strength, and deeply appreciate all the work that you and Matt and all the others have done over there and continue to do. Okay, so let me start with where we are around the region. I think Israel has emerged the victor in every one of the seven fronts where it was fighting. I might even add that there was an eighth front. That was, of course, the attack that the Israelis launched on the microstate of Qatar back on September 9th of this year. And that shifted the balance of power to essentially instill fear into the hearts of the Qataris who had been sponsoring and harboring Hamas. And that was essentially, I think, the moment that forced the Qataris to the table. They came running to Donald Trump asking for security guarantees for the future. And Donald Trump told them, yeah, we can do that, but you've got to deliver Hamas. And that brought us to the end of the conflict, or at least to the ceasefire where we sit right now. It is undeniable to me that Hamas is a shell of itself. It is battered inside Gaza. It controls 47% of the Gaza Strip, not 100. The Israelis control 53% of it. They control 47, and I suspect that that is going to shrink the space that they control over time. We can talk more about Gaza if that's helpful to you.
Absolutely.
I would then go to Lebanon. We of course see that Hezbollah is trying to stage a comeback of sorts, but the Israelis, as you may have seen, continue to strike targets with complete impunity. You hear Hezbollah saying that they're making a comeback. They're not in any real sense of the word. The real question is whether the Lebanese government is determined to keep this threat contained. Right now, the Israelis are their best weapon, and that's a bit ironic, of course, given that Lebanon is not rushing to engage in normalization with the Israelis. In Syria, we see an enemy that was vanquished. We're, of course, talking about the Bashar al-Assad regime back in December. They were routed by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the former Nusra Front al-Qaeda affiliate group that was based there. The new leader is talking a lot about moderation. Ahmad al-Sharaa, otherwise known as Abu Muhammad al-Jolani, is talking a good game about a new Middle East. But I will say that the massacres that his army continues to perpetrate against minorities in Syria does beg the question whether this is truly a leopard who has changed spots. I'm not sure that I'm ready to buy this yet, but we are seeing the repealing of sanctions, the normalization of ties across the Arab world and even in the West with the new Syrian regime. The UK just dropped sanctions. The US is set to drop sanctions. I still have my serious concerns, but I will say it's a darn sight better than what we had with Bashar al-Assad in power. In Iraq, it's a very strange thing, but you still have a dozen and a half or so Shiite militias that are aligned with the Islamic Republic, but they are the dog that did not bark, not during the June war between Israel and Iran, and not since. And that is remarkable to me. I cannot explain everything that's going on. But they do appear to be chastened. They do appear to be deterred. And I would argue that that is a good thing. We are watching, of course, in Judea and Samaria, another front that was active and remains active during the war. That does not look like it's calm, but I would also argue that the Israeli reservists, and it is almost entirely reservists with some specialty units that go in almost nightly to remove weaponry, to arrest militants, to arrest terrorists. They're doing a tremendous job, and they have kept the West Bank to a low boil. And that is about as good as you can get in Judea and Samaria. They have found some missiles and rockets of late. That is concerning. They have found larger networks of individuals. There are actually two Turks that were arrested recently in the West Bank smuggling in weapons. We are hearing about Iranian weapons and cash. And fighters that are still coming in across that very porous border with Jordan. The battle is not over, but right now, at least for now, it appears to be contained. The last two fronts, I think, are a little bit more dicey, but I think still have been very quiet. The Houthis have been held to a dull roar of late. We watched them for the better part of 2 years firing missiles and rockets at Israel. They have largely halted this activity since Hamas entered into its ceasefire with Israel. The Houthis always vowed that they would continue to fight so long as Hamas was fighting. Now that Hamas is not fighting, the Houthis have stopped. If we can hold this ceasefire together, then I think the Houthis will also continue to refrain. I am concerned, though, and this is maybe a note for the future, they're still building up that missile arsenal. They have not forgotten how to fire at Israel. They have not lost the will to fire at Israel. So I would say that this is an entity that is still a threat to the Jewish state. I think it's a threat to Western shipping in the Red Sea. This is an issue that is unresolved, even if it has gone quiet. I will also note, as perhaps a last note as it relates to Yemen, I do think that a lot of this can be solved with one eliminated leader. And here I'm speaking about Abdul Malik al-Houthi, the leader of the Houthis dating back to, I think it's 2004 already, which is remarkable. But I sort of look at him not unlike the figure of Hassan Nasrallah, the longtime leader of Hezbollah, when he was killed in October of 24, that was the moment that Hezbollah collapsed. And it was because this was a cult of personality. This was a strong leader that was the gel, the glue, if you will, for the terrorist organization. And when he was gone, there was really no one to replace him. I think the Houthis are somewhat similar in this respect. And I know that the Israelis are looking for Abdul Malik day in and day out. He's not getting a lot of vitamin D right now. I think he is below ground and very afraid to come out. But I think the Israelis, the folks that I talk to say it's a matter of if not when they find him. And I suspect that day is coming. And so here's hoping that the Houthi threat gets put to bed. The last kinetic threat that we saw during this war, apart from, of course, the Qatari front, was Iran. And there, I think, we continue to hear about the Iranians potentially starting to move rubble around in the Natanz area, the area known as Pickaxe Mountain. We know that they are still amassing the capability of, pulling together more ballistic missiles to fire at Israel. They learned a lot from the last conflict, or from really the last 2 years. They have the ability to continue to fire again, and that is something that the Israelis are keeping a close eye on. On top of that, they have the desire to replenish their air defenses. Not that the Russian-made air defenses did much of a difference in the last round of conflict with Israel. They actually proved themselves to be utterly useless. It does beg the question of who would want to buy a Russian air defense system right now. I think their market is thinning out rather rapidly. There's rumors of Chinese replenishing of these systems. I can't say one way or the other whether that's happening. We just know what's being reported out there. But I would say that unless something drastic happens, the Israelis and the Islamic Republic are due for another battle, possibly next year or the year after. I wish that were not the case. I spent time in Israel during that 12-day war, and I could see how harrowing it was. I mean, I was very lucky. I was in Jerusalem where, nothing really happened. We just had to go into shelter every few hours. But, in other places around Israel, they could see the just horrific impact of these missiles that are the size of a bus carrying 1,000 pounds of explosives, shearing off the side of a building. This is not something that Israel wants to have to endure again. But I do think that there's an understanding in Israel that it may be necessary in order to counter the Iranians and to engage in what would likely be a preemptive conflict. To ensure that the Iranians don't have that long-term capability. Now, the last thing that I'll just mention, and that gets to your question of the Turks. As we watch the Iranian ring of fire get drenched, quenched, it's losing its fire. It is starting to look like it's sputtering out in some ways. In some ways, I'm still worried about it, but of course, it's my job to worry about such things. I am concerned that the Turks are rebuilding and getting closer to Israel and strengthening their position as it relates to the Israelis. Now, you may recall that during the war, the Turks, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, in particular, the strongman of Turkey, called for an Islamic army to rise up against Israel, a pan-Islamic force. Now, that never happened, but you get a sense that the Turks are working with the jackals around the Middle East to try to coordinate a more unified Islamic front against Israel. I look at a country like Malaysia, for example. They're a sponsor of Hamas. I look at the Qataris, of course. They're sponsors of Hamas. And then look at what they're doing immediately around the region. Of course, the Turks are trying to insert themselves into post-war Gaza, a horrific idea and something that the Israelis are pushing back on. And I think mostly the right messaging coming out of the Trump administration, but not 100%, which does bother me. There is that bromance between Donald Trump and Recep Tayyip Erdogan that is yet to be resolved, in my view, favorably. On top of that, the Turks have been working in Lebanon quietly. This is not well known, but they have been providing weaponry to Hezbollah. Not in large quantities, and Hezbollah is, of course, still loyal to Iran, but the Turks are involved with them in ways that I can't fully explain yet. And the reports are somewhat clear about this coming out of Israel. They are trying to put Turkish troops into UNIFIL, the UN interim force in Lebanon. I don't want Turkish troops there, loyal to the Republic and to Erdogan, purportedly trying to prevent a clash between Israel and Hezbollah while the Turks are providing some amount of weaponry to Hezbollah. You can see the insanity of this scenario. In Syria, we know that the Turks are crawling all over the new Syria. They are trying to provide new weapons platforms to the new regime. They are training the new regime. They are sitting in meetings with the new regime. The Israelis have bombed a number of Turkish assets that have been brought into the country. This has created tension between Israel and the Turks. The Israelis are unflinching when it comes to threats on their own border, but the Turks are unbowed. And so we're watching this with some trepidation. I think this is a flashpoint. I don't want to say that there'll be, dogfights over Damascus, but I would say that this could be a shadow war that goes on for quite some time, with the Turks moving in assets, the Israelis bombing them, the tempers flaring on both sides. Not a good situation. We know that the Turks are part of the Muslim Brotherhood Axis, which means that they're working with the Qataris to try to spread Muslim Brotherhood movements around the region. That would include places like Jordan and Egypt. And it doesn't mean that they're welcome there, but it also does very likely mean that they have influence in these places. So when I look at the map right now, I see a weakened Iran and a weakened Iranian axis. I see a stronger Israel relative to all of its traditional enemies. And the enemies that were baring their teeth at Israel on October 7th in the immediate aftermath. In that sense, I think Israel is much stronger. But again, I think when we look at what's happening with the Turks, perhaps to some extent with the Qataris, specifically their money and their influence, I like to think of the Qataris as the money and the brains, and the Turks as the brawn behind the Sunni Islamist movement that we see trying to flex muscle across the region right now. I don't like what is happening. I don't like the influence that these two governments have. They were the ones, admittedly, that worked with Donald Trump to broker this ceasefire agreement with Hamas. They're the guarantors of Hamas to some extent or another. In other words, Donald Trump said, "I need Hamas delivered." They brought them to the table. They offered them up, including the 20 live hostages and the 15 dead hostages as of Tuesday. That they've all been returned. And so, in other words, Hamas and their patrons have hewed to the 20-point agreement as stipulated by Donald Trump. Maybe not exactly on the timeline that I would have preferred, but they have at least stuck to the basics. The question now is, are they going to turn away from Donald Trump? Are they going to try to buy more time, to buy more latitude for Hamas? And are they still trying right now to insinuate themselves on Israel's other borders as a means to pose a threat for the next generation to come? These are the big questions that we ask ourselves right now as the Middle East goes through some rather significant tectonic changes.
So I have more questions, as you might imagine. So you said that Israel is in a relatively better position relating to every threat on its borders. New threats may emerge. Israel is, but you also said it was sputtering, and sputtering is not peace. So the question is, as Israel looks at its neighbors and its circumstances, is this just an interregnum before the next war? And if it is, what needs to happen not to get us there? That's the first question. I'm going to stop there. Then I have an add-on question.
Well, there's always an add-on question.
Absolutely.
There always is. There are no permanent victories. As my colleague Cliff May says, there are only permanent battles in the Middle East. You think even back to the 1967 war, this was the exclamation point, the most emphatic victory that Israel could have ever achieved in the Nasser, Pan-Arabist era. All of its most threatening foes were defeated in a sweeping 6-day victory. And 6 years later, right back at war. I think that is a good indicator for where we might be. Just because a war ends doesn't mean that it's going to stay static. And I think that right now, the region, if you ask me, it's still percolating. There is still the anger toward Israel. I think if you ask me, October 7th, obviously there was the sense that Israel's borders were breached and that it led to a new conflict. But it was blood on the ground that I think spurred on so much more of this. There was this sense that you could force Israel to bleed, you could injure Israel. This gave Israel's enemies perhaps a sense of opportunity. And I don't think that that has fully dissipated, that psychological sense that Israel's wounded or weak, and that this could be an opportunity to exploit. We continue to see it from various actors around the region. And so when you look at what Israel's doing right now, there is, number one, a sense of just taking a little bit of time to heal. And they need it. They're exhausted. Their fighters have been on the battlefield for 2 years. This war has cost an estimated $90 billion, which is no small matter for a country of Israel's tiny size. They have expended a lot of munitions, and they need to replenish. They have frayed ties with a number of countries, some of whom may never come back as allies or nominal allies. And of course, I'm thinking here about the Spaniards or the Portuguese or the Irish. I mean, I don't see them ever coming back into the fold. I think they've torched their relationship with Israel for probably a generation. But there are other countries that I think Israel is still trying to get back into the good graces of, of the leadership, the Brits, the French. It's the Germans, the Western Europeans they need to do this with, because Europe is a key trading partner for Israel, and they've traditionally viewed, I wouldn't say they're close allies, but they've had relationships that have been meaningful and useful and helpful for both sides. And that needs to be rebuilt, patched up, if you will. And so there are things that are happening right now that I think are important for Israel's health, and its ability to wage war again in the future. I would like to see as much time as possible between the last round and the next round. I think that's healthy for Israel. However, not at the expense of Israel's long-term security. And I think that is the balance here that I'll be watching for. The Israelis, people talk about the errors made on October 7th and the blind spots. The biggest blind spot, in my view, was this notion that Israel could forestall the conflicts that were looming with all of its enemies, because there was never a right time for war. The idea that, Israel didn't want to absorb the pain of a conflict with Hezbollah. I think the record now shows that had they fought that war sooner, it would have been less painful and the problem would have been solved much sooner. In other words, they should have set off that beeper operation on day one. These are the sorts of things that I think Israel learned. And this is the October 8th mentality, right? You can think about the things that your country needs in order to, heal itself and to hopefully try to put it on a better path toward the future. But that path to the future will entail battling Israel's enemies if and whenever necessary. And I think finding that balance right now is going to be an interesting thing for the Israelis as they are exhausted. They all want to go back to whatever normal looks like, but I don't know if the new normal is what they thought it was.
So you mentioned France and Britain and Ireland and Spain and all kind of places. But at the moment, you haven't mentioned the United States. So we had a guest on a couple of weeks ago who made what I thought was a point I hadn't heard before, and I thought I'd heard everything. He said this may be the last war or the last round of war in which Israel can count on the United States. Because if we run out of Donald Trump time and we get an increasingly difficult Congress or a Democrat president in the next election, Israel may not be able to count on the kind of, I mean, Donald Trump, just whatever Israel asks, whatever Israel wants, is basically behind Israel. Is this the last war? If they wait too long, could they change their relations with the United States?
So I have to say, I've heard these sorts of analyses, and I don't want to say they're wrong, but I think it may be premature. And I know that, there is the, the headline grabbing Oi Gewalts that, we all sort of look for. There's always something to worry about. I will say that this prime minister will not be popular among Democrats.
For
Bibi
sure.
Netanyahu is, roundly hated by the left in the United States. He's accused of war crimes, and but let me just say, think about somebody like Ariel Sharon, right? The butcher of Sabra and Shatila in the 1980s. And he leaves the scene. Yitzhak Rabin comes, and he becomes the darling of the United States, the darling of the left. And when he was, when Ariel Sharon was there, this is like at the sort of height of the one of the waves of anti-Israel activism. It's in the wake of the Zionism equals racism campaign at the UN, and you can feel the throbbing hatred for Israel throughout this entire period. It's a 10-year period or so where nothing that Israel does will ever be accepted by the international community. And then we shift into peace mode. New leaders, new politics, new mode of operation. And then for a number of years, things are going quite well. And Israel has a lot of, I don't want to say that it's total sympathy around the world, but it has a lot more goodwill. And then, of course, then you see the war break out, the Second Intifada breaks out in 2000, or actually even the first one in 87. And it does change things, right? Each time another war breaks out, and Israel is the stronger party. And every time Israel has the audacity to defend itself, it finds itself getting attacked by the left. But eventually, we go back to an equilibrium. Israel eventually goes back to trying to find a way forward in the Middle East, and things begin to change. I will say that there's some other interesting theories that I've heard out there. One is that when normalization occurs with Saudi Arabia or with some other countries in the region, that will be the thing that paves the way for the American left to be more accepting of Israel. But then there's the other theory that I heard from Yossi Klein Halevi the other day on my podcast, which was fascinating. I never thought about it. But leave it to Yossi Klein Halevi to articulate something like this. He said, what if the ties with the United States, they may not collapse, but they may not be great in the hereafter. But what if the trade-off is that Israel is more accepted in the Middle East, and that it finds itself actually accepted in the region increasingly as it loses some stature here in the West? I don't know what the likely outcome here is, but what I would say is that Israel has gone through the ups and downs of various boycotts, I mean, and various isolation campaigns. 48, when Israel was founded, it was ostracized and alienated, right? I'm thinking about, and then after that, you had the Arab boycott that lasted throughout the 50s and 60s. You had the oil embargo in the 1970s that put a lot of pressure on the Israelis. Zionism equals racism, right? Every war that Israel's fought, Sabra and Shatila, Intifada number one, Intifada number two, Durban, right? I mean, think about all the times that Israel has been singled out as the Jew of nations and emerges on the other side only to battle back some more. And I think it's too soon to say that, it's lost American support. Right now, this is a low point. It is. Maybe the lowest I've seen in my life, but that doesn't mean anything. In the broad scheme of things, Israel has found a way time and again to return.
So that's supposed to be an optimistic statement, I know, but it seems to me then that you're still talking about sputtering in cycles, and all of those cycles were down to not to Israel's benefit, actually, but to the benefit of people that don't like Israel. I mean, there was a time when Hamas didn't get the support that it gets now, and magnified, of course, by social media, and also magnified by the fact that a lot of people don't think about these things. So I find that a very pessimistic thought, that in the middle of Israel's greatest victories, you point to 67, and even 73 was actually a great victory, terrible cost, but a great victory. it's still all on Israel's head to make everything work, and I find that depressing. Now, two questions. First, tell us where to find your podcast, because people need to know that. Where we find your podcast?
Sure. It's called the FTD Morning Brief. It's on FTD's website. We go live every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 8:30 a.m. But you can catch it throughout the day. You can see it on YouTube. You can catch it on Spotify, all the different places that you get your podcast. It's just called the FTD Morning Brief. It's 25 minutes. And the goal really is to get you up to speed, the news over the last 2 days, or I guess three on Mondays. But with the idea always of sort of the news that you wish you would see on CNN or Fox or BBC, with the granularity that we all, I think, would crave, but we just don't get. And then I do an interview with, sometimes it's people I agree with, sometimes it's people I don't agree with. But the idea is always to try to teach and try to go a little deeper into the issues. It's been about the war. We have done more than 250 episodes. And the goal is just simply to inform. There's no other reason. And it's abuse that I keep putting myself through, waking up early, tracking the headlines, watching it in Hebrew, watching it in Arabic, trying to just bring people the best information that we can get.
Okay, so that's important, everybody out there, FDD Morning Brief, you should watch that. Now, the other thing that goes with this in the context of cycles of ups and downs and betters and worses, what happens if Israel is able to take out one of the major players? Look, Iran funds Hezbollah, Iran funds Hamas, Iran. You talk about the Houthi missiles, where the money come from, where the ships come from. It's all Iran. Do you have to take out Iran to change the real pattern? It's almost like abusive spouses, you know. They beat you up and then you come back and say, do you have to take out Iran? Or increasingly, do you have to take out Turkey? Now, I don't mean to go to war with Turkey and destroy it, but move it out of the equation. Is it enough to just keep pounding on Houthis and Hezbollah and Hamas?
No, it's not. And that's the sort of the thing that the Israelis always talk about with the tentacles of the octopus versus the head of the octopus, and the strategy that we had toward the proxies. I think that, a few things to note here. Number one is Israel took it to the tentacles and to the head of the octopus. The entire octopus is rather beat up right now and doesn't seem to have a lot of pluck. And I think that is an achievement, and I think it was a message sent, message delivered, message received. The rest of the region is looking around right now. They see not only did Israel do this largely on its own, but they did it with American weaponry, which is, I think, now a good sign that maybe more weapons can be sold. And this is something that the Trump administration undeniably is looking at, and I think they're understanding that this is probably a good opportunity, and it's coming at the expense, as I mentioned, of countries like Russia, whose weapons failed. The air defenses that also were deployed that saved Israel from bombardment, not entirely, but really did save Israel from a lot of pain and destruction. That's also very attractive right now to other countries in the region. And so you get a sense that we're on the precipice of something new and different. That if the United States wants to create a new regional order, a US-led Middle East architecture, that this is the moment to do so. And this actually brings us right back to Turkey and Qatar. And I would actually also add Oman to this mix. And most people don't think about Oman. Most people can't point to Oman on a map. But Oman is the country that's next to Yemen, and it also is the headquarters of the Houthis. And it's an American ally. Not a good look. Same with the Turks, same with the Qataris, right? These are countries that are American allies. They have bases, they have American servicemen and personnel. And then at the same time, they're sponsoring Hamas. They're sponsoring Al-Qaeda, the Muslim Brotherhood, ISIS, Taliban. I mean, it's insane that this has been allowed to happen. What I think is that right now the region is just starving for leadership. We need to dictate what the rules of our alliance structure, what that's going to look like moving forward. And that's not necessarily on Israel, right? I mean, Israel can continue to give it as good as they get it. And they continue to do that. And I think it's impressive that they're able to. They have the wherewithal, they have the military capabilities, they've got the army, and they're doing it. They don't want to fight Turkey. They don't really want to fight Qatar. It's not a fair fight, by the way. I mean, Qatar can be conquered in like 30 seconds. It's a country without a military. But this isn't like, it's not the answer at the end of the day. I do think that defeating the proxies were important. It was a sign to the rest of the Sunni world, like, hey, this Shiite upstart, we spanked them and now understand that we're here to stay. And it's time for everybody to get under the same tent, if you will. And that tent is the American tent. And I think that if you ask me right now, we have allowed our alliances in the Middle East to, well, we've allowed them not to operate at our standard. In other words, how do you let the Egyptians, for example, they're building tunnels that are allowing rockets to go into Gaza. It's a huge problem. And by the way, they have a peace agreement with Israel and they're slamming Israel daily, calling them an enemy. Not a good peace partner, not a good piece of the US-led architecture. Same thing with Jordan. I mean, the vitriol toward Israel throughout a war that Israel neither wanted nor started, that shouldn't be something that we allow the Jordanians to do and keep paying them billions of dollars a year. We've been giving money to the Lebanese armed forces, even as they've done nothing to counter Hezbollah for decades, right? I mean, you look around the region, the Turks and all of the mayhem and mischief that they've been up to since 2011 or 2010 was the flotilla when Erdogan first announced himself to be an enemy of Israel. What are we doing here, folks? Why are we allowing the Turks to do this? The Qataris, why are they allowed to host Hamas and to give $30 million a month to Hamas since 2017 and still be identified as a major non-NATO ally? So broaden out, and what we see here is that the US has a bunch of great allies around the region, but they're not acting like a cohesive alliance structure. Now, the analog here that I've been pointing to of late is look at Europe. Okay, Europe was a disaster. It kind of still is in many ways, but they were not working with the United States. In fact, they were working against the United States. We kept saying, you need to put more money into defense. You need to apply more to NATO. You need a common defense against common enemies because those common enemies are coming, and the United States is soon going to have to pivot to Asia, right? We've got a conflict with China. It's looming. Europe, get it together. First Trump administration, you have a bunch of officials, they go to Europe and they say, guys, you got to start spending, you got to start building up for your common defense. And they tell Donald Trump to go pound sand. And they all of a sudden realize it was a huge mistake. You see, 2022, Putin goes in, invades Ukraine for the second time, and all of a sudden they're, whoa, wait a minute, we have a problem. Trump comes in again and he says, remember me? Yeah. It's time for you to start contributing to your common defense. And this is not what we asked of you, specifically the Germans. They're a little weird about this. They're like, well, you told us we weren't supposed to fight, but they now realize they have to. They're going to have to put some skin in the game. And what Trump has done, and I don't think it's all Trump, I think some of it is just what's happening in the region. It's a natural consequence of the threats that are forming and the challenges that are out there. But there's an understanding now among the Europeans that it's time to get their act together. And this is what we need to convey to our friends in the Middle East. That if you want peace and prosperity, and you want to be able to counter the threats that may be coming on the horizon, whether it's a renewed Iranian nuclear program or it's some other actor, some other threat actor, right, that we can't see because it's around the corner, but you're going to have to start working together, not fighting separately or amongst one another. And this, I think, is the moment where Israel has a role to play, a leadership role to play. But it will not happen without the United States. And the question is whether the US is willing and able to demand this. needs of our partners?
So looking at various partners, Egypt, for example, should be on the same page as the United States, as Israel, and maybe the United States, and against Turkey and Qatar, because they are the Muslim Brotherhood, and the great fear of the Egyptians is the Muslim Brotherhood. They've outlawed it, they've been through it, they've gotten rid of it, and Israel helped them get rid of it and helped them get rid of the threats in the desert. So Egypt, though, says, oh, come on, Turkey, let's have a meeting. Come on, Qatar, let's have a meeting. And then they go off to Sharm el-Sheikh. What's keeping them from acting in their own interest? Is it a failure of the United States to push them? And if it is, how do we push? Do we threaten their money? Do we threaten their arms? Or is it something else? Is there a higher loyalty, even if you're worried about the Muslim Brotherhood, that
Yeah,
you don't want to go against the Muslims with the Israelis?
you have put your finger on something, Shoshana, that I wish I could give you a clear answer.
Well, that's
I
why
can
you're
give you,
here.
of
Give
course,
me your experience.
but I can give you scraps of information that I think can help us try to figure this out to some extent or another. First, I mean, let me just say that Egypt is not what it was. It used to be the capital of the Arab world. It used to be crucially important for the United States. It is a country of 100 million people with poverty that we can't even begin to fathom. It's lost its power. It just does not have what it used to have. It does not have the political power. It doesn't have the financial power, the military power. It's a mess. The capitals of the Arab world now are not Cairo and Damascus and Amman. The capitals of the Arab world right now are Riyadh and Abu Dhabi. And so Egypt has lost its luster, and it may not ever regain it. And I think there is a lack of attention to Egypt. And I think, by the way, that is a risk that we're taking here in the United States by maybe just shrugging and saying, well, that's their problem. I do think that China and Russia are likely, elbowing their way in. I think that the Qataris and the Turks, with the threats that they've posed to the Sisi regime, they have more leverage than people realize because the Sisi regime is weak. I think we're seeing inroads made by the Qataris and the Turks. They have a better relationship now with Egypt than they ever had. And that bothers me greatly. I think it's a huge mistake. We look like we're ceding a country that was once not a great ally. It was always cold peace and it was always ambivalence, but it was stable. And now it looks like we're ceding ground to the Chinese, to the Russians, to the Qataris, to the Turks, all the wrong actors you don't want. But then there's the one other thing that I don't really get. I can't tell you everything that's going on over there right now. I mentioned before the tunnels, and the tunnels have been, they were identified, and then the Israelis began to walk it back. And I was really hearing from, when I talked to folks in Israel, they were kind of saying, well, Egypt's kind of too big to fail, and we need to like be much more careful about how we talk about Egypt. And we can't blame them for everything that goes on. It's a weak state and they don't know. And I'm not sure I buy that. But we're now hearing reports that there's a buildup in the Sinai, that Egyptian military assets are moving in numbers that are making the Israelis far more nervous than anybody's reporting. We hear reports, unconfirmed, of underground facilities capable of storing missiles and rockets that would be deployed to Israel. There's no other enemy that the Egyptians have in mind. More tanks and personnel than anybody had ever envisioned under the Camp David Accords. And I think very well constitute a violation of those accords.
They do.
We don't know exactly what's happening. What we do know is that the Israelis are sharing these concerns. We know that the Egyptians are nervous about a flood of, Palestinians crossing the border, but I don't think that's ever been a real possibility. I think they're using this potential moment of crisis as a means to build up. And the Israelis and the United States have a lot of work to do, in my view, to try to counter this and to bring things back to equilibrium. And I'm not sure how well we're doing, primarily because we've been at war for 2 years, and the Egyptians, I think, have operated under the fog of that war. It's time to dial all of that back. How you do that now is a fascinating question that I don't know how to answer.
And I suspect it can only be done with American leadership. Look, the Egyptians began moving their equipment into the Sinai with Israel's permission because they were working against ISIS and the transport of weapons to Africa. And Africa is a whole other question that really does need to be addressed. But maybe we'll get to it, maybe we won't. But as the ISIS threat and the Brotherhood threat waned in the Sinai, they didn't take them out, and the Israelis didn't tell them to. So they're definitely in violation of the actual Camp David Accords. The question now is, are they in violation of this sort of other agreement that they made with Israel so they could work together in the Sinai? And that's much less clear. But it seems to me that if you want something from Egypt, Israel can't get it by itself. The U.S. has to be, and I agree with you, there's no path, there's no clear steps that we would take, except I suspect that it has to be done together. Like everything else in the region, the U.S. and Israel operate together as a strong horse. The United States has to be there. The biggest thing to me was the United States
correct.
Participating in the Iran bombing, because that's the message you want the Arabs to have. Okay, take the same level of concern about kind of waffly allies. I don't want to use the word allies. Turn it to Jordan, you know. And by the way, to the West Bank and Abu Mazen, and you talked about the Israelis operating in Judea and Samaria to keep the pot at a low boil instead of a high boil. It seems to me that the Israelis are keeping Abu Mazen in power, because the first thing that would go is him. And the Jordanians as well. What do we do with those people?
Yeah, I mean, look, you say, I think, I remember talking to a senior Israeli official, I don't know, a couple of years ago, talking about some of the lower level threats that Israel faced. And it was the height of the Iran, you know, nuclear threat and, you know, the Arab Spring. And there was just so many headaches. And this official looks at me, he says, "Why are you talking to me about this? They got to get in line. They got to get in line behind all of these other bad actors. I don't have time for this right now." Right. And I was sort of struck by this because I was thinking, this is a real threat. This would be a real threat on any day of the week. But then you've got this Israeli mentality, like under siege from seven other fronts. And so these guys are like not even, you know, like a they're a, not even a secondary concern. It's like a tertiary concern. The problem in the Middle East is that these sorts of tertiary concerns become primaries overnight. Look at Turkey, okay? Everybody was just, "Oh, don't worry about it. They're, you know, they're a NATO ally. They're friends with the United States, and you know, they're kind of annoying. And I don't like Erdogan, and he's an anti-Semite." But really, is this really? Yeah. Look, now it's all everybody talks about, and you know, the Israelis are trying to figure out how to, you know, learn Turkish overnight. And boy, is that, you know, a stressor, right? I would argue that these two countries or two territories that you mentioned, Jordan and the West Bank, there are similar kinds of concerns. With Jordan, look, we all know that it's a weak state. We know that they just disrupted a major Muslim Brotherhood plot that could have done serious damage to the Hashemite kingdom. We know that economically they're in bad shape. We know that politically they're struggling. It's a mess. But they are a crucial buffer state that Israel needs. But really, if you ask me, the biggest thing that Israel needs right now with Jordan is a border fence. It's unbelievable to me that the border between Israel and Jordan has gone I don't want to say unchecked, because there are, of course, forces on either side, but this is highly porous, this border. I've actually taken a helicopter ride over the Israeli Jordanian frontier, and I'm shocked. There's nothing. Like, there's no buffer zone. There's nothing there. And you now see that weapons are coming across and fighters are coming across and cash is coming across. But the weapons and the cash are significant, right? This is money that's paying the terrorists in the West Bank. But it's also missiles and building materials for possibly tunnels or other kinds of military assets that terrorist groups can deploy. What's needed right now is a demarcation fence that has the same kind of technology that we've seen in Gaza. Not that that was perfect, as we all know, but that it could be used to hinder and prohibit the wrong people from coming in. If you're going to have a buffer state, make sure it's a buffer. I think that's kind of the big message that I would say about Jordan right now. I don't expect, Ayman al-Safadi, the foreign minister, to start singing Hatikva. The guy's got a forked tongue when it comes to Israel. He's nasty. I don't expect that to change. And I think, by the way, that only serves to undermine the Jordanian kingdom when he starts speaking that way. He riles up his 80% Palestinian base to the point that he can't get them to dial it back. That's his problem. But if you can keep the border secure and you can make sure that the Jordanians take care of their problems while Israel takes care of its problems, that's something I can live with. As for the West Bank, you may have seen this past week Abu Mazen named a successor. It was about time. The guy is now almost 90 years old. He is 20 years into a 4-year term. Total political corruption, total economic corruption, and just a mess of a leader. I mean, a guy that is, I mean, he brings nothing to his role any longer. He falls asleep in meetings. He's not healthy. And he's just hanging on for the sake of it. And we just don't see any political vision for the Palestinian Authority. I think that actually right now there's some interesting things happening that are worth keeping an eye on. A lot of people talk about Palestinian reform as the thing that, maybe helps us build Gaza into something that's useful. I gotta tell you, I have no hope for the Palestinian Authority, at least not right now. The leadership that they have is a disaster. There's no political horizon, there's no political participation, economic corruption out the wazoo. There's really not a lot you can look to right now that says bright spot. Okay, they just named a guy that could step in for 90 days as a successor. In which case, they have elections where they probably elect what, Marwan Barghouti? I mean, really, a disaster. But let me just say this: you have the ability right now to create something different in Gaza. And whatever that difference is, whatever we're trying to build, it's going to be with the help of the Emiratis and the Saudis and maybe some other actors, Indonesia, which we're hearing maybe on the precipice of normalization with Israel. Not that these are democratic states, don't get me wrong. But they're pragmatic and they're moderate. And if they get involved and they help create a government in the area beyond the yellow line in Gaza, there is the possibility of creating something that is more respectable, sustainable, pragmatic, moderate, all those things, right? Where it's not that the West Bank takes over in Gaza, but rather whatever is built in Gaza could become the template for the West Bank. And people don't think about it in that way. Now, I understand that in Israel, there's not a lot of appetite for empowering the West Bank to become independent, and they had to fight against the campaign for Palestinian statehood at the UN and elsewhere. I get the resistance to it, but a lot of the resistance has stemmed from the Palestinian Authority's inability to maintain calm, peace, legitimacy. I mean, there's a lot of problems. Part of the problem is we keep trying to recycle this same tired, beat up government that Yasser Arafat created, and it was born in sin. Maybe you create something out of this war that turns into something more positive, but it starts in Gaza. It doesn't start in the West Bank. Maybe there's something there. Maybe.
So I like to end a program with an optimistic note. You just gave us an optimistic note, which is nice, but I'm not going to let you get away with it quite that easily. You said none of the potential partners are democracies, and there will never be a democracy, in my opinion, in Gaza or in the West Bank. And I'm not sure that I want one, because I'm not sure that democracy is the only form of government that works for people. You have sheikdoms, you have kingdoms, the American No Kings movement had to change its name because the British got irked because they have a king, and the Swedes have a king, and they all like their kings. There's nothing wrong with a kingdom. There's nothing wrong with a protectorate. There's nothing wrong with other forms of government. So I would say one of the things the United States should stop doing is saying everybody has to have a democracy, a parliament and a vote and it's change of powers and opposition parties. I don't think so. Which would to me be the best reason to have the Saudis or the Emiratis in Gaza, because they would not be demanding what they don't do. And so maybe the real benefit of them is that they can see other forms of government. We tried a voting democracy in Iraq, not so much. You know, voting democracy, the Palestinian Authority, they voted for Hamas. I think we need a new approach, and maybe that's how you get it. But the bigger thing to me is you have to disarm Hamas first, and no one wants to do that. No one. The Israelis don't want to do it. They really don't. They were hoping that to get a surrender. Who's going to do it? And if you don't get that, and if you do have perpetual warfare, because Hamas makes it that way, how do you get to the political horizon anyway?
So I'm going to end on, I guess, maybe a mixed bag kind of.
Okay.
I don't know if I'm going to give you all, you know, unicorns and rainbows here. but I would say this. First of all, what Israel has achieved after this war is remarkable. And, you know, we talked about the 7+ fronts, how Israel has weathered the storm and emerged intact, bruised but intact. But it's not just that, you know, they survived the 7-front war and everything seems to be going okay, all things considered. When you look at Gaza, it's not what it was, right? Look at where Israel's deployed as of Tuesday, October 28th, as we're recording this. The Israelis have 53% of Gaza under their full control. That is a buffer zone well beyond what was ever discussed.
Yes.
They did not have to withdraw their troops during this transfer of the 20 live hostages or the dozen or so slain hostages. They were able to hold their ground exactly where they were. And they don't have to leave until it's done.
True.
They have Hamas pinned down within the yellow line. And if you look historically at these colored lines all over Israel's borders, these are lines that don't change. Okay? Think about the green line around Judea and Samaria. It's still there. The blue line after Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon in 2000. The purple line in Syria after 67. These lines, they're the law. Now, if this is where Hamas remains now in 43% of the Gaza Strip, with the ability for Israel to push forward or to go in as needed, with Hamas now operating at a third or maybe a quarter of what it once had, with fewer options, much less ability to maneuver, it's an achievement. It's a win. Now, is it full obliteration? No, but that can happen over time. I would argue that fighting an asymmetric war where you have your enemy pinned down in an area where, it's already a lot more warning for the Gaza envelope if rockets are fired. And the idea of anybody rushing the fence to attack Israelis, all but nil. The threats are diminished significantly. And so I take that as a win. It's not an absolute win. You can't say, you know, peace in our time. But like I said, in the Middle East, that's not usually how it works anyway. So I think Israel is in a much better place than it was, even if it doesn't get everything that it wanted. It got a lot. I never thought the hostages would be home. The live hostages are with their families again.
Yes.
Amazing.
Amazing.
You know, I mean, look at all of the things that Israel achieved. It is remarkable. I just don't know if, you know, we don't, as we always say, don't let the perfect get in the way of the good. Right now, Israel has gotten things to a good place after 2 years of a grueling fight. I'd like to see them lock in those gains.
Me too. I think that's a great place for us to stop. It's optimistic, but not wildly so. And maybe that's the best we get. You know, best anyone gets. Okay. Jonathan Chancer, thank you for a great hour. Thank you for the enlightenment and the perspective. And it's always good to talk to someone who's recently been in Israel because you bring us a little bit more of the reality on the ground. It was terrific. Thank you. I hope you'll come back again. Maybe we'll do a live one next time.
Sounds good to me.
Great. Thank you.